Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're getting a great start to your weekend. Coming up later this hour, Bill Mechanic recently resigned as a governor with the Motion Picture Academy Board, and he sent a highly critical letter on the Academy to the head of the organization. The critique included a number of concerns. We'll talk with him later on Film Week here on KPECC. But first, of course, we've got the reviews of the week, and lead us through those, Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times and Film Week film critic, and Leah Lowenstein, our Film Week critic. We begin with Avengers Infinity War. The cast is back in this latest Marvel all-star film, which is co-directed by Anthony and Joe Russo, who are brothers, co-written by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. Justin?
Well, as sort of a Marvel agnostic who likes and dislikes his share of the franchise, I'd say, does this movie get the job done? Yes. And that's sort of what's wrong with it. I feel like there's a lack of inspiration beyond just getting the characters, marching them through their paces. This movie feels more like crowd control than direction to me, because there are upwards of, like, I think two dozen of just the principal superhero characters on top of everyone else. You know, this is the culmination after 10 years since the first Iron Man and 18 movies since then. This is the 19th Marvel Cinematic Universe installment. There is this tremendous sense of convergence that all the different, you have the Avengers, you have the Guardians of the Galaxy and other kind of far-flung
you
heroic
Spider-Man,
factions.
Spider-Man, for instance.
Spider-Man, yeah. Who, you know, it's a jumble. And I do think that they've organized the movie pretty well. You know, you do feel like the arcs are kind of, they dovetail nicely. There's a decent sense of pacing and rhythm. The movie runs close to 3 hours and does go by fairly quickly. So but to me, I feel like the Marvel machinery has just, it's become just that. It's machinery. I feel like everything is very efficient. Everything runs very smoothly. The jokes land on the deaths. And yes, there are deaths in this movie. Sorry. Spoiler alert. We should preface this, Lael, right?
Right.
Everything in this movie counts as a spoiler. And,
yes.
But they've been, and the stakes are higher this time.
Okay. A few things it's important to add. First of all, this is, this is the first of two standalone films. The second will be released a year from now. They are both directed by Anthony and Joe Russo, who have done other installments in the Marvel Universe world franchise, including the two Captain America movies, which I really liked.
Yeah.
I think they do a pretty commendable job harnessing all the characters, and including Black Panther, who we came to know and love recently. Doctor Strange, you've got Benedict Cumberbatch, you've got so many superheroes. It's like a smorgasbord of superheroes, and it's a little too much at times, because you're trying in your mind to sort of balance how everybody fits together and how, you know, wait, what if something happens to this person in this movie? Can they still exist apart from this? You know, there's all kinds of things. Obviously, we're not going to give away what happens to who, but I will say this is perhaps the darkest of the Marvel movies that I have seen that I can think of. In fact, there's a joke. Character makes a joke at one point about, why so dark? Are you from the DC universe, actually? But this, you know, it's, gosh, you've got a talented cast. You've got three Chris's, Chris Evans, Chris Hemsworth, and
Chris Pratt.
And Chris Pratt.
Of course.
You've got most of the core group of Avengers, minus Hawkeye. You don't have Ant-Man, but you have a lot of the peripheral characters, the superheroes that have been brought in. I kind of agree with Justin's point that it's starting to feel a little bit mechanized, but there are laughs. There are great action scenes. It just felt heavy and long. And as I looked over the shoulder at someone texting last night while the credits rolled, before we were waiting to see if there was going to be a little teaser, which there was. You have to wait a very, very, very long time. She wrote, you know, I don't know how I'm going to get those 3 hours back. And this was someone who had paid to see it before it came out, which was, you know, you could go on the Thursday night. So I think fans will mostly be happy. I think neophytes, maybe not so much.
Well, and I wonder about, you mentioned that there are deaths, and you always wonder in a movie like this, are those permanent deaths, or will there be resurrections?
Without being specific, and if we're allowed to go there, It's funny because there's, I won't be specific at all, but this I would just say, because I think it's these movies more than any, I think, invite interesting debate about what does constitute a spoiler and what is even the purpose of film criticism if we're not allowed to actually talk about what happens in the movie.
Well,
and so I'm not going to go, I am not going to go there. I emphasize that 100 times. But I do think that this movie kind of spoils itself, I would say, because there is that sense of that what happens in this movie should be, you know, you're right, Lael, that this is like the dark one. They've hyped it up. It's dark. I actually think it's kind of faux dark. I think it's kind of a beige movie, actually, because at the end of the day, I just say the ending, I did not trust what I saw. I did not believe in it. I couldn't take it seriously. And I don't think that there is any sense of catharsis that I kind of want. And I know that that's partly because
This is like the Empire Strikes Back. Ends with a lot of stuff.
The Empire Strikes Back is cathartic, though. Well, there's emotion in there.
Okay,
I just felt like dangled off a cliff in the most gimmicky way. Wait till the next one.
You felt manipulated.
I don't object to being manipulated, but I just think these movies are a Ponzi scheme, and it's just the most cynical thing. Wait till the next installment.
Sometimes they're fun, though. Sometimes this was less fun for me, but you know, intermittently enjoyable, but I thought wildly uneven.
Yeah. All right, Avengers Infinity War, the latest Marvel film. All the superheroes gather together under the direction of Anthony and Joe Russo, the brothers. The film rated PG-13. It's everywhere. Disobedience, a romantic drama starring Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams. The movie is directed by Sebastian Lelilo, who directed A Fantastic Woman, which was the 2018 Best Foreign Language Oscar winner, and Lelio also co-wrote the film. Lael?
Yes. Lelio is a Chilean director, and I thought Fantastic Woman was from Venezuela. Do you remember? Was it Chile?
Santiago, okay. I believe. Yes.
Right. Yeah. Well, anyway, which was a wonderful film about a transgender woman with a terrific central performance. This film, like that one, also deals with issues of identity. It focuses on two women, the two Rachel actresses, Rachel McAdams and Rachel Weisz. Rachel Weisz is a photographer living in New York who has left her extremely repressive and conservative Orthodox Jewish community back in England. She goes back because her father, a rabbi, has died and is confronted with the fact that her life is so very different from that, and yet she has some friends, including Rachel McAdams, who she also once had a relationship with when they were very young, and how to navigate her feelings. Rachel McAdams, it's fair to say, comes on to her, even though she is married and in this very cloistered relationship, and you know, it lives a very Orthodox life. So much has been made of the kind of passion and the sexuality that's displayed between the two women. And I was watching an interview with Rachel McAdams where she said she didn't mind that because this is a movie about desire. And to publicize that doesn't exploit it. It actually presents it in a realistic way. I don't care for this film as much as Lelio's other film, Fantastic Woman, which I felt dealt with identity in a more kind of poignant way. But this is still rather well done and I thought beautifully acted.
Very beautifully acted. And I mean, I've always been a big fan of Rachel McAdams, mm-hmm. and I feel like sometimes the need to defend her because she's not, you know, she was Oscar nominated for Spotlight a few years ago, but sometimes she isn't as taken as seriously because of her Hollywood comedy work. And I think this is kind of a breakthrough performance for her. Rachel Weisz is excellent as well. No surprise there. And the relationship is powerfully done. I would agree. Maybe it's not as striking a film or as original a film as A Fantastic Woman or Gloria, Sebastian Lelio's previous film. He makes wonderful films about women, it must be said, and all different kinds of women, including the ones here. But I think it does show his versatility. I mean, A Fantastic Woman was such kind of an aesthetic delight, very stylized, Almodovarian. This one is like gray and grim, North London.
Very somber,
You cloistered in every sense. You feel like immersed in this Orthodox Jewish community.
Which is interesting because the physicality between the two women stands as such a striking contrast to the somberness of their surroundings.
There's like a contrast, and yet at the same time, there's this... It's in a way, I mean, you know, there's so many films made about the tension between spirituality and sexual desire, and how there's a desire is kind of the common theme there, and it kind of juxtaposes them in a really interesting way.
Well, it's funny because what you're saying is you wouldn't necessarily know that Lelio had directed this film coming out of the unless someone had told you
that's
that.
That's right.
And this is his first English language feature as well, too, and you wouldn't guess that a non-English native speaker had directed it. So,
Disobedience is the film from writer-director Sebastian Lelio. It stars Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arclight, Hollywood, and the Landmark in West L.A. And on the frame, there's an interview with star Rachel Weisz. You can hear that conversation of the frame and John Horn by visiting kpcc.org/theframe. Kings, a drama in South Los Angeles set back just before the time of the L.A. riots. Halle Berry, Daniel Craig, Lamar Johnson star. The film is written and directed by Denise Gamze Erguven. Leo, what'd you think of Kings?
I was pretty mixed on this movie. I very much love a film that this director made a couple years ago called Mustang. It was a Turkish film about a group of adolescent girls who are coming into their own and are sort of railing against a sort of oppressive family life and come into some discovery. And so there's a lot of kind of joy and pleasure and kind of ebullience with these girls. This is a very different kind of movie. It takes place during the and leading up to the Rodney King riots. It begins with the LaKeisha Harlan story, a girl who was shot in a grocery store for allegedly stealing a carton of milk. And that, you know, and it does sort of set the stage for the context of what was going on around the time leading up to the King trial and the verdict and so forth and the riots. So there's a lot of unrest. I think you have a better experience of seeing that or experiencing that from, let's say, any of the documentaries in the last couple years.
Yeah, we had so many because of the anniversary.
And the combination of the original footage in those that we saw, the OJ one, for example, was just so extraordinary. I think the script is kind of weak, and I thought Halle Berry was fine, but a little bit hysterical. I don't know.
And Daniel Craig plays her angry, boozy, loudish neighbor next door who eventually becomes her love interest. So you have this very weird James Bond association with both of them.
It's very odd. Yes, I was thinking about that too. Weren't they typical
casting for the
two of them? Shows sometimes the compromises that are made when you're mounting, you know, an independent feature production about a difficult subject matter. You need a commercial hook of sorts. And this movie feels compromised from beginning to end. It also feels like something that was much longer originally.
Yeah.
I would actually think it would be better at closer to 2 or 3 hours. It's only like under 90 minutes.
And she wrote the script too, the director.
She wrote the script before Mustang. This was her big, ambitious project. And I think she couldn't get the financing. And so she decided to make something smaller and more intimate, which Mustang was, and that was a wonderful film. There's a kind of a thematic link between them. I think she loves images of children and teenagers at play.
She's wonderful with child actors. The best of it, actually, in a way, is the stuff with the children.
The children. Halle Berry has these eight foster children, and they're always just kind of getting underfoot, and some of them eventually will become ensnared in the violence that breaks out, some of them helping to initiate it, and some of them just swept up in the wrong place at the wrong time. But nothing really just connects the movie. You know, there's a lot of archival footage, TV news footage from the violence and the unrest, and you just feel like, could they not afford a more expensive recreation? So I think there's this attempt to really situate this drama within this, you know, within the reality of the situation, but it just feels like a jumbled mess of tones and intentions.
Yeah. Kings is the film set in South Los Angeles leading up to the Los Angeles riots. It's rated R. It's in selected theaters. We have many more films to talk about coming up on Film Week, but I also want to invite you to come to our next Film Week screening. It's in our ongoing series. Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles began life as the classic United Artists flagship theater. We'll be there for our next Film Week screening, the movie The Graduate. I've never seen it on the big screen. I'm sure many of our Film Week listeners haven't seen it on a big screen. We'd love to have you out to see it Saturday night, June 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, 7 o'clock, with a post-film conversation. I sure hope that you can join us. It's going to be a very, very special night. It's our Film Week screening series, all of the movies set in Los Angeles. That's certainly true for The Graduate. All right, much more to come with this week's reviews in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk with longtime producer and studio executive Bill Mechanic. He recently resigned from the Board of Governors of the Motion Picture Academy, and he had a critique on several major points about the direction of the Academy and concerns about the organization. He joins us live coming up later on Air Talk. Right now, our critics reviewing the week's new films, including the Argentinian-Spanish co-production Zama, which is written and directed by Lucretia Martel. Justin, what do you think of Zama?
I think this is one of the best films of the year so far, and it's also one of the more challenging films of the year, and I don't think that those things are accidentally linked. This is a movie that I really encourage people to see. It does not move or behave quite like any film you're likely to see this year, but I think that's very much to its point. This is an adaptation of a 1956 novel by Antonio Di Benedetto, an Argentinian novelist. Lucrecia Martel is Argentinian as well. This is her first film in close to 10 years. And it follows a Spanish magistrate, an official of the Spanish Empire in the late 18th century. And he's stationed in this remote rural backwater in kind of what is now Paraguay. And the movie is almost this Beckett-like, Kafka-esque tale of just him waiting his transfer to from this godforsaken place somewhere else. But he's just waiting and waiting, rotting away, thwarted by his superiors, rebuffed by this noble woman that he lusts after, and she's married. He's married too, but he hasn't seen his wife and children in a very long time. And this sense of waste and rot and despair and futility becomes a very powerful metaphor for the ravages of European colonialism and imperialism. And it's powerful. And Martel films it in a way that is very striking. And it takes, again, I emphasize, takes some time and is worth the time it takes to follow the narrative as it unfolds. The way she frames scenes, for example, she's always showing you, like, the slaves in the background, the animals wandering through. She doesn't just position you in the easiest place to necessarily discern what a scene is trying to say. She gives you this extraordinary sense of, it's not quite realism because you feel like there's a certain stylistic kind of eccentricity to this as well, but she, you know, the sound design of this movie is exquisite. You hear like insects buzzing, and it's one of the most humid and atmospheric kind of, you know, and this is very much typical of Martel's method. She previously directed films like The Headless Woman and The Holy Girl, which are also excellent and highly recommended. I think this is just really extraordinary and well worth your time to watch this film.
All right, a rave for Sama, one of the best films of the year so far, Justin says. Written and directed by Lucrecia Martel. The film is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and Lemley's Playhouse, Pasadena. Adventures in Public School, a comedy that's directed by Kyle Rideout, who co-wrote the screenplay with Josh Epstein. Lael?
This is a ridiculous movie, but it's actually pretty enjoyable. Judy Greer, who has now made a pastime of playing sort of harried moms. I'm thinking of People, Places, and Things, this film. She was in the Clint Eastwood movie about the 310 to Paris. She is just delightful. For a long time, she was just a sidekick, but now she's sort of been promoted into the mom category. She plays this very overprotective mom who has homeschooled her teenage boy and is planning for him to pass his high school equivalency exam and go straight to Cambridge and become the world's second most important physicist. He goes to take the high school equivalency exam and sees a girl and with a wooden leg, by the way, and immediately falls for her and decides he wants to tank the exam. So he erases all his answers and decides to enroll in school. So it foils Judy Greer's plan, and it sort of throws a wrench into everything. It's surprisingly, you know, again, it's cheesy, it's ridiculous, but the it's played for everything it's worth, and Judy Greer is just so good. It's nice to see her shining. So I kind of recommend it.
Adventures in Public School, unrated comedy, directed by Kyle Rideout, who co-wrote the screenplay with Josh Epstein. The film is at the Arena Cine Lounge in Hollywood. The Rachel Divide, a documentary about Rachel Dolezal, who had been the head of the Spokane, Washington NAACP when her racial background came into question. The documentary's unrated. Lael?
Wow, this was a... Justin is nodding like, we've got some stuff to talk about here. Interesting. Okay, so I don't know if... remember when Rachel Dolezal was exposed as the biologically white head of the regional Spokane chapter of the NAACP and had been, I guess, caught in an interview being asked if she was African-American and sort of refusing to answer, and then this came out. This was a few years ago. And there was a lot of controversy and publicity, and everyone thought she was just kind of a kook. There's a lot more to the story than I knew about at that time, and what this documentary does is actually bring up some of that, bring up some of what happened in her childhood, that she was raised by allegedly very abusive parents, that she had African-American brothers and sisters, that she, one of whom she later ended up adopting, she was, she began to see herself to identify as Black. And she still, to this day, I think, has trouble kind of seeing herself as white because she grew up oppressed and became much more comfortable identifying with the Black community. The problem is she could never say, okay, I'm white. You're right. I messed up. And even now still has trouble. This is focusing around her writing a book about her story and how that was dealt with.
It's, you know, and this is a documentary on Netflix, and a lot of people have been angry, I think, even at Netflix for why are you giving this woman a platform? And we hear this throughout because as she's writing this book, as she's going on the New York Times Facebook Live, you know, feature, as she's, you know, speaking at things, everyone kind of asks, why are you giving this woman a platform? And then right. The question rebounds on her, like, why are you still putting yourself out there? And mm-hmm. There's people, including her son, say, like, you know, who are extremely sympathetic to her and torn. But there's this sense in which, okay, if she had just said, yes, I was born white or biologically white, but, I, you know, people would have, this might have blown over or gone away to some extent. But the movie becomes this pretty fascinating and intimate look at how she just cannot let it go. She still is on social media and she kind of posts things that seem to be almost baiting a reaction.
Right.
She just
yes.
can't let it go. And it's this conflicted portrait.
The filmmaker asks her at one point, why are you still on Twitter? Why are you tweeting? Why are you posting? Why don't you just give it up? If it's inspiring, if it's causing this hate mail and things like that. And she says, because this is the only way I can keep my presence out there, which is weird. I mean, it's indicative of some sort of deeper psychological issue that's going on. To me, it was fascinating in another way because of sort of a portrait of a mother who is trying to keep her family together and her kids sort of going from kind of innocence to experience and growing, beginning quite sympathetic towards her, but partway in the film, they acknowledge, you know, look, this is kind of messed up. I'm going to need to step away. I'm going to need to get a little distance from my mom because it's getting too much for me to deal with.
Real quickly, because we need to move on, but Laura Brownson, the director of this, how is the filmmaking? I mean, aside from the person at the center.
Very good. You hear Laura Brownson sometimes speaking, asking questions. And I think the most impressive thing she does here is that this movie is sympathetic to her, to Rachel Dolezal, but damning. The more sympathetic it is, the more damning it is of her. It does give her a platform, I suppose. But, you know, there's also a lot of the most eloquent and just powerful kind of damnation comes from her former colleagues in the NAACP who lay out very clearly how this is just an embodiment of white privilege to be able to to consider oneself transracial.
Right. That part of it is interesting.
The Racial Divide, the documentary at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills and streaming on Netflix. It's unrated. The dramatic comedy, The House of Tomorrow, stars Asa Butterfield, Alex Wolff, and Maude Apatow. It's written and directed by Peter Lavolsi in his directorial debut. Lael?
This is a quirky little movie. Buckminster Fuller, one may recall, invented the geodesic dome. He came up with terms like synergistic. He thought spaceship Earth, I think, was his term. This kid is raised in the dome. Ellen Burstyn is his grandmother. He's very sheltered, and he's sort of raised, indoctrinated into the philosophy of what Bucky would have wanted, who he may or may not have some sort of familial connection to. When someone, a church group comes to town, some of whom have a connection to the punk scene, believe it or not, and this kid becomes kind of fascinated by that, sort of gives up everything that he had been raised to believe. His grandmother's horrified, and it's a sort of, when it works, it's kind of juxtaposes again the innocence and experience thing. Like, you know, can you keep this child in a box or in a dome rather, or does he have a right to explore the world on his own? And in the end, it sort of posits this theory that Buckminster Fuller himself was a punk, was sort of like an original punk, and so it sort of all comes together in a sense. It's kind of a mixed movie. I didn't love it, but it was a nice directorial debut, I suppose.
The House of Tomorrow, the film at Lemley's NoHo North Hollywood, Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, and the AMC in the City of Orange. It's unrated. Also out this week, The Great Silence, the 1968 film from Sergio Corbucci, who directed the film and co-wrote the screenplay. Justin, The Great Silence, the 4K restoration, what do you think?
I think it's pretty terrific. I hadn't seen this film, and it's had never been released in the U.S., and so this is its 50th anniversary. Corbucci has been, you know, prominently championed in recent years by Quentin Tarantino. Corbucci's film Django, and you know, was one of the inspirations for Django Unchained. And this one, you can really see the influence on Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. It's a winter western. You know, it's shot beautifully by Silvano Ippoliti in the Dolomites in northeastern Italy, but it's set in a town called Snow Hill, Utah. These farmers have been driven off their land, and they're forced to resort to criminality and banditry as a result, and a price has been put on their heads. There's a bounty killer named Loco, played by Klaus Kinski, in a very chilling performance that's actually pretty restrained compared with his, you know, very notorious and famous performances for Werner Herzog. Yes, and Nosferatu as well. You know, and the hero of the movie is a man named Silencio. He is a mute because of an accident hit that killers slashed his vocal cords when he was much younger. And he's played by the great French actor Jean-Louis Trintignant, who took on the role because he didn't have to learn any lines for it. And so, you know, like a lot of spaghetti westerns, this movie has a very lurid, ludicrous quality. That's what makes it so much fun. But there's also a real political dimension to it, too. And I think that's why it made censors nervous, with just the bleakness, the fatalism of its ending. Themes of capitalist corruption and preying on the underclass, and a prominent African-American role for played by Vonetta McGee, who would go on to become a blaxploitation star.
Yeah, yeah. But always stands out in those films. If you're a fan of blaxploitation movies, she's always good.
She's always good. And she and Jean-Louis Trintignant's character have a love scene that is, you know, not overly explicit, but bolder and more candid. And, you know, for an interracial romance, there's a real boldness to that. So this is a movie that, you know, ends in a very bleak way. In fact, Corbucci was forced to shoot a different ending, and I recommend audiences see it now so they can see it as he intended.
All right. The bleaker ending. The Great Silence is the Euro-Western from 1968. Sergio Corbucci, the director and co-screenwriter, the film is unrated, and you can see it on the big screen of Lemley's Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we take a look at the future of the Motion Picture Academy. Recently resigned governor of the Board of Governors, Bill Mechanic, longtime studio executive and producer, will talk with us about the reasons why he resigned, his critique of the Academy, and will open up the phone lines for other Academy members to weigh in. Back right after this. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us, whether you're tuned in live Friday at 11 o'clock or listening right at the middle of your Saturday, every Saturday at noon here on 89.3 KPECC. And, of course, the podcast available wherever you access your favorite podcasts. Well, Bill Mechanic was the top of the studio business at Fox, executive with Disney. Under his leadership, those studios turned out many different top films. And he's now the president, chairman, CEO of Pandemonium Films. He also, for several years, was a member of the Board of Governors of the Motion Picture Academy during a time when the Academy is going through intense efforts to diversify itself, to build and open up a museum adjacent to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and to make changes in the way it operates. Bill Mechanic recently resigned his Board of Governorship position and sent a letter to the head of the Motion Picture Association outlining his reasons why he was leaving a leadership role in the organization. We invited him to join us, and he accepted. Bill Mechanic, it's good to have you with us today on Film Week.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me.
First of all, you share with us, just in an overall sense, before we get into the specifics, what do you think are the biggest challenges, either in leadership or direction of the Academy?
Well, the biggest challenges are the business is changing, the Academy business itself is changing, having to manage a museum beyond the changes in the industry, and the board of directors, the board of governors, has become so large it's unmanageable.
And the increase in the size of the board of governors, is that directly related to the diversification effort?
No, not really. The diversification effort is different. The board has increased because more branches have been admitted as governors, and each branch still has three governors per branch plus one for diversity. So it's the board now is 54 people strong, when I would think the most reasonable size would be somewhere under 30 and probably closer to 20.
And as a practical matter, what does this increased size mean? Is it just harder to make decisions, or that the focus becomes more diffuse? What have you seen?
Well, there's two things. One is that, the branches that make up the Academy are, you could demarcate them between above the line and below the line, and there's a very vocal minority in the above the line, and a more silent majority in below the line. And so it's not board majority that's really ruling. It feels like, in some ways, the louder voices are ruling.
And you think, though, that with the larger board of governors, it might be more difficult for that smaller group of vociferous people. How are they able to, in your view, carry undue weight?
Well, again, I think in the above the line, producers and directors and executives tend to be more public spokespeople. And I think it's intimidating to walk in a room with 54 people and voice an opinion, especially when somebody will shout you down. So I think it stifles discussion.
We're talking with Bill Mechanic, up until recently a member of the Board of Governors of the Motion Picture Association, which, of course, puts on the Oscars. In fact, Bill Mechanic produced the Oscars just a few years ago. But I'd like to ask those of you that are Academy members, if you're listening to our live Friday broadcast, this is a chance for you to come forward and share some of your thoughts. What do you think of the critique? We'll get into the specifics that Bill Mechanic offers in his letter. What do you think about some of the changes that have occurred in the past few years in your organization? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. One of the critiques you offer in your letter to the president of the association, John Bailey, is, you write, "We have settled on numeric answers to the problem of inclusion, barely recognizing that this is the industry's problem far, far more than the Academy's. Instead, we react to pressure. One governor even went as far as suggesting we don't admit a single white male to the Academy, regardless of merit. Elaborate a bit on this. And are you saying that you think some of the people recently admitted as members that their body of work would not have in the past made them eligible, or you know, expand on this?
Well, again, let's start from the get-go, which is the Academy doesn't hire people in the business, so it doesn't make movies, which makes it hard to really affect change at the level that it needs to be changed. If there's racism in the industry, it's racism at a higher level, at this either, and I'm not trying to pick bones with studios, but at the studios or the financier level, that if you're going to change things, you have to change it. At the guilds, you have to have more cinematographers that are women. You have to have more people of color in positions of authority, in writing, and whatnot. So, the Academy is just is downstream from all that. Its real job is to pick the best movies to honor, and you can only pick from what's out there.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just gonna say. So when you're looking at increasing your representation, I've never met any kind of, or seen any kind of racism within the Academy itself. I think people always want to do the right thing, but there's a standard of excellence that when you just say we have to meet a goal of numbers, that you're probably, you know, knee-jerking a reaction, as opposed to how do you do it in a disciplined way that actually brings the Academy into the modern age. I don't think anybody's against.
Do you think that looking back a few years when there was heavy criticism for there not being diverse Oscar nominees, do you think at that time that the Academy in its selections was representative of the industry? Because I think a lot of the portrayal in media and by critics was that there were high-quality films with more diverse casts and creative people that the Academy was overlooking. Do you think that's incorrect?
Yeah, I do believe that's incorrect. I think the Academy can only, again, choose from what's out there. So I don't think people were not intentionally selecting things. And I think, again, I think the criticism was fair that there's racial, gender, and color imbalance inside the Academy and that something should be done. I just thought there should be a more disciplined approach to it. You don't just open the doors and say that's our answer is doubling the number of minorities. If you could double the number of minorities and keep the standards of the Academy, then that's what should happen. And I think the last couple years after reacting to pressure, I think things have gotten way more disciplined.
Okay, so then it sounds like you're saying in this doubling, in this effort to increase the numbers of people of color and women within the Academy membership, that you think the standards were changed. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and again, if you want to bend, and I think everybody does this, if there's a bending of things, I think that's okay. If there's a breaking of things so that you're in a different standard, then I think it's different. And, you know, one of the ways that the membership has diversified is by making the Academy more international in focus. And again, a lot of that does is eliminate, you know, more commercial movies. And God knows most of the commercial movies aren't good enough. But there's probably more discrimination right now against mainstream movies than there is against anything else.
We'll talk about that movement and commercial films versus Oscar bait movies with Bill Mechanic, longtime motion picture producer as well as former studio executive at Fox and at Disney. He recently resigned from his position in leadership at the Board of Governors of the Academy and sent a letter to the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, John Bailey, outlining the reasons why he left. We'll talk about more of those reasons. And if you're listening live Friday in the 11 o'clock hour and you're an Academy member, I'd like to hear from you. 866-893-KPCC. Back in a minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, and I sure hope to see you in the audience Saturday night, June 2nd. Historic Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles' South Broadway Theater District. We're going to show The Graduate on the big screen, the 50th anniversary of that classic. We're going to have a post-film conversation. It's going to be a great night, and I sure hope that you're going to be there to join us. Our Film Week screening series, Quarterly Movies on the Big Screen, all of the films set in Los Angeles, and they're some of my favorites. In this case, it's a movie I haven't even seen on the big screen. It came out when I was a kid, and I'm looking forward to seeing it right there with Dustin Hoffman, Catherine Ross, and Anne Bancroft, Larger Than Life, on the big screen. I hope you'll join us for that Saturday night, June 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel. Reserved seats are on sale right now, kpecc.org/in-person. I hope to see you there. Right now, we're talking with motion picture producer and former studio executive Bill Mechanic, up until recently a member of the Motion Picture Academy's Board of Governors. I mentioned he's also a former producer of the Oscar telecast, and we'll get to his critique of that, which was included in the letter that he sent to the Academy President John Bailey, outlining his critique and the reasons for his resignation. Bill, I did want to ask you, though, about commercial films and their place in the Oscar nomination process, because, speaking of The Graduate, we look back at earlier classic films. They had that ability to be both audience-pleasing and to be critical favorites as well. Much more difficult to see that now, and most of the Oscar-nominated films play before very small audiences in theaters. Is there a fix for that, or is that just the state of the industry today?
Well, it's sort of like the inclusion issues. The Academy doesn't make movies, so you can't fix imbalances. You can't make movies better. All you can do as an Academy is to lobby for better things. So I don't think you can turn back the pages. You know, the days of David Lean are largely gone. But you know, a film like Dunkirk, which is the most commercial movie, probably along with Get Out last year, are almost afterthoughts because the ramp up to it are all these smaller shows that basically right now support more of the small films than they do the big films. And big is, as I said in my letter to the resignation letter, big is not inherently bad and small is not inherently good. Good is good and bad is bad. And yes, I think the industry itself needs to, the filmmakers, everybody has to resist the pressure of just making movies for deadlines and just making pre-sold commodities. And I guess the best example right now is Black Panther, where Ryan Coogler clearly is a real filmmaker and pushed for a more, a better film out of it.
Okay, but you don't necessarily think in recent years the Academy has been overlooking high quality mainstream films that should have been considered that weren't?
Yeah, I mean the model of all that would be Dark Knight, which there are people who won't vote for a comic book movie, and we'll see if that changes with Black Panther, but I would say those are the two best comic book movies based on comic books maybe ever made.
I thought Wonder Woman was terrific, too, and it got overlooked.
Yes, same thing.
Yeah. Bill Mechanic, I want to talk about the Oscar telecast because you actually were responsible for it a few years ago. Clearly, the audience is eroding isn't even the right term. It's really abandoning it. It's more than an erosion. And what do you think are the factors behind that? Why do comparatively fewer people want to watch the show?
Again, you're asking me, there's complex answers to simple questions. So, like all these things, I don't think there's an answer. So if you just go through I think three main things. One is there's too many awards. The same, it's grown from, I think, the original telecast of 5 or 6 awards to where there's 24 awards that all take times. And if you add the opening and commercials, that basically almost takes you to the full 3 hours. So anything you do as a producer to try and make it more entertaining is fairly de minimis. You can't have that much of an impact. So I think you have to start looking at what awards should be televised on that show and start eliminating things. You know, in the last 50 years, essentially, everything's been added and nothing's been subtracted. Second, you've got to look at the question you asked a minute ago is, how do you get better films? You know, how do you get films that there's a rooting interest in? I produced the show the year of that Hurt Locker won, but Avatar was nominated. And it didn't matter that Hurt Locker was, I think, the one of the lowest grossing pictures because it was a tight race that people cared about between would Avatar win or would Hurt Locker. So the ratings were the highest they've been in, I think, in the last decade.
The other thing is, I'd argue, Hurt Locker, people knew what it was about, and I do think that makes a difference. Even if people don't see it, they feel more of an investment if they know what the theme of the film is.
Right. Yes, I think just if you're in the mainstream, if you're in the discussion, if you're part of the conversations, there's a reason to watch it. But I think, you know, the third reason is, in this particular year where the ratings dropped off precipitously, is out of the last 3 years, you've had the Oscars have turned into a political show and everybody gives speeches instead of celebrating the movies. And I think it's great to do that on the red carpet, and certainly not saying people shouldn't speak their piece, but people should speak their piece in the red carpet or afterwards, because everybody wants to hear from a winner, and less on the show itself.
Well, and especially I think the challenge is that the politics are all sort of coming from the same perspective, so it's right. Less interesting. I'm really right. Curious what it would be like if there was a difference of opinion among people being honored in Hollywood, that you actually were hearing sort of, you know, a sideshow political debate between people. But I don't think that's going to happen soon.
No, neither do I. I think it's you're right. It's all coming from a central place. And again, I think everybody in the Academy is well-intentioned, and none of these issues are issues that shouldn't be discussed or we shouldn't do our best to fix. I just think when you're on that night of nights, which you're in you're in the business of celebrating motion pictures, that you should celebrate the motion pictures and have the discussions afterwards.
All right. And just finally, I've got like 30 seconds for your response. Your thoughts about the future of the museum. I know it's the cost is a huge issue in the planning. When it's done, are you looking forward to it?
I hope so. You know, I don't know. As a governor, I don't know enough about it. That's one of my problems. And I think if I can do one thing, today is the last day of nominations for the elections for the Board of Governors. And your listeners that are Academy members should be taking an active hand if they don't think it's being well run, and what the board needs is more active members and people who will speak up. I'd say the museum is not being managed properly, just as the Academy itself is not being managed properly.
Bill Mechanic, Chairman, CEO, Pandemonium Films, up until recently a governor of the Motion Picture Academy. He's since resigned. From all of us at Film Week, have a great weekend.